From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. This week, New Republic science editor Judith Shulevitz wrote one of those articles that got people talking, and the title will tell you why. How Older Parenthood Will Upend American Society. The article detailed some of the problems associated with older parenthood, and it touched a nerve that we'll explore in our next hour of Forum. What are the societal implications of having children later in life? What does it mean when expecting parents aren't thinking so much about blue or pink, but gray? Having babies later in life. That's our topic ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It's a fact that fertility rates for women decline dramatically after age 35. It's also a fact that technology can sometimes trump biology. So-called assisted reproductive technology, methods ranging from drugs to in vitro fertilization, can expand the window of would-be parenthood so that women can have children into their 40s and sometimes beyond. And they are. In 1970, only one woman out of 100 had their first child after the age of 35. Now, it's more like one out of seven. It means that women can now take greater control of their family and career choices, but are there also costs? This week, the New Republic's Judith Shulevitz wrote a story that explored some of the possible consequences of trumping the biological clock for children, for parents, and for society. Her piece was titled, How Older Parenthood Will Upend American Society, and it sparked a wave of response that we explore in this morning's Forum. Joining us, Judith Shulevitz, the author of that cover story, How Older Parenthood Will Upend American Society, in the current issue of The New Republic. She joins us from New York this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
And joining us as well, Elizabeth Gregory, director of the Women's Studies Program at the University of Houston and author of Ready, Why Women Are Embracing the New Later Motherhood. Elizabeth Gregory, good morning as well.
Good morning.
And joining us here in our studio, Joan Williams. She's professor of law and director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California's Hastings College of the Law and author of Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and Class Matter. Joan Williams, good morning.
Delighted to be here.
Thanks all very much for being with us. Judith Shulevitz, in the end, these stories are always so personal. So I'd like to begin, if you don't mind, with yours. You became a first-time mom in your late 30s, and when your son was about three, you wound up discovering something. Describe what happened when you went to the pediatrician one day and what that got you started to thinking about.
Well, the first thing I did when my pediatrician said I should have him checked out for fine motor delay is scoff. Because I thought we live in a world of overdiagnosis and overlabeling. And then about 3 or 4 months later, I noticed that my daughter, who was 18 months younger than my son, was doing all sorts of things with her hands that he hadn't gotten around to doing yet. And I began to worry. And a few months later, I did have him tested, and he turned out to have fine motor delay and later was diagnosed with something I still don't quite understand. It's a sort of grab bag of diagnoses called sensory integration disorder. And the reason I brought this up is not that he has such severe problems, because he doesn't, so his handwriting isn't great. Mine wasn't as a child. It may have just been genetic. But because I spent a lot of time in these occupational therapy gyms, sitting on these little child-sized chairs while my son was given treatment for, you know, low muscle tone in his upper body and a poor ability to grasp things. And I watched a parade of children with much more severe problems go by me. I was living in a suburb of New York at the time, and I noticed that most of these women were older. And I wondered if that meant anything. It was just all anecdotal and, in a sense, didn't mean anything, but I wanted to look into it further.
And you write in your article that what science tells us about the aging parental body should alarm us more than it does. So we'll explore this over the course of the hour. But in brief, what are some of the things that you discovered about what science tells us about that aging body?
Well, the really important point here is that science is changing. Our understanding of the body is changing. Genetics is changing. So we understand things and we see things we weren't able to see before. There's two really key points here. One is that we no longer think strictly in terms of genetics. We also think in terms of gene expression, how genes get turned on and off. And those things, That act, the turning on and off, first of all, drives development, and second of all, responds to environmental cues, which in the scientific sense includes age, as well as exposure to toxins, nutrition, et cetera, et cetera. So we're reopening questions we hadn't opened before. We're seeing things we didn't understand before. And we also have technologies that let us look at genomes and what are called epigenomes, these patterns of gene expression, and see things very clearly and establish not just correlations, sort of matches between things that happen and things that might cause them, but actual causation. So we're learning things we didn't know before. And I think some of the things we're learning are alarming.
And what are some of those things? Again, I know that – what can you tell us about what we know and what we don't about things that we've read? For example, the association between older dads and autism.
Right. So older dads and autism, older dads and schizophrenia, older dads and various neurological conditions, we're starting to understand that as men age, they produce more mutations in their sperm. You know, men keep making sperm throughout their lives, whereas women don't keep making eggs. They sort of make as many as they're going to make in the womb. And there's a chance, there's some debate, maybe they make a few more later, but it's unclear. So every time a man's sperm cells divide, there's an opportunity for a copy error. And as he ages, those copy errors become more numerous, in part because the cell repair mechanism or the DNA repair mechanism, I meant to say, ages and doesn't work as well. And those mutations can misdirect development. And there's been studies in animals that show that the offspring of much older fathers actually have a different brain architecture. And that has neurological effects. And many of them are more inhibited, more shy, slower to learn. So it's possible that older men are contributing to a whole spectrum of neurological disorders. So that's one thing we're able to see, and that might be genetic and that might be epigenetic. We're still sort of working that out. Another thing that people are beginning to look at is the effect of these hormones that women take during assisted reproductive technology, which can function as what are known as endocrine disruptors. That is, they can alter the way hormones sort of flow through the body, and this is really important in early fetal development. Hormones are signals the body sends to itself to, you know, undertake certain steps in development, and they affect gene expression. And I hope this isn't getting too technical, but the upshot is that the drugs we're taking may be changing the way our babies develop in our bodies.
And what's
fertility?
Finish up, please.
I was just going to say the fertility industry in America is absurdly underregulated. As are these drugs. So my basic point is we're tinkering with biological processes we're barely beginning to understand, and it's scary.
And part of what also is significant about the story that you just told, much of which was about the role of older men in this, is that while it was that gym full of older women that first got you thinking more about this issue, this cuts across genders. This is not just a question of older parenthood being solely about the biology of women.
Absolutely not. And that, I think, is one of the more radical implications of what I'm trying to argue. This is not a woman's problem. This is a human problem. You know, we have had older fathers throughout history, but they are aging. The age of first birth for men is keeping pace with the increase in the age of first birth for women. So this is a human problem, and I think it may change the politics of the issue.
Let's hear some other perspectives on this. Elizabeth Gregory joining us as well. She's at the University of Houston, an author of Ready, Why Women Are Embracing the New Later Motherhood. Elizabeth Gregory, what's your reaction to the argument that Judith Shulevitz is making?
Well, I interviewed more than 100 women, 113, who had had their first child at or after 35 by birth or adoption. So it was a whole range of issues associated. You know, they weren't just biological. They were also social issues, and Judith does sort of point to those in her essay very briefly, and I just want to focus a little bit on them for a moment and then come back to the biological issues. The women I talked to were overwhelmingly happy with the experiments, with their experiment or their experience, both at the same time, the social experiment that we are undertaking, and I looked at a lot of data around the phenomenon. You know, the phenomenon of later birth in terms of biology, economics, sort of social structure issues. And one of the major things that is not addressed in this article, and which I think is key, is the issue of women's voices in making policy. And in the history of the world, women have not had a voice in making policy, and this is basically due to uncontrolled fertility. So they started having babies when they started having sex, and that meant that they had a lot of babies. They were never educated. They couldn't get jobs in the public sphere. They had no money, very little influence, and as a result, the politics and the policies of human society have not fully reflected women's concerns and insights because women have been stuck in the kitchen. And men have also not benefited from those insights. And birth control changed that, and the big drop started in the 19th century. Average woman had 7 babies in 1800. She had 3.5 in 1900, so it wasn't just birth control. It was rubber. And then in 1975, it's 2.0 and forward. So huge effect on women's role in society, and hormonal birth control introduced the possibility of delay. So before, people were having fewer kids, but they were still starting earlier. After the pill, they could delay and go to school and start at work and trickle up into roles where they could start making policy. And in a way, you could say that the paradox is that it's only when women delay kids or refrain from having kids at all, which some have done, is the point when you're going to get a more family-friendly world, because you'll have women in policy-making roles. And you're starting to see that already with Elizabeth Warren's insistence. She's going to talk about equal pay, you know, when she gets to the Senate. Before that, nobody was talking about it. Before that, you know, nobody was talking about the possibility of a national child care system. And it's only when women are in the room that those things can happen, which could lead to the point that Judith mentions at the end, where, you know, we have different social structure, people would have different choices around delay, because the reasons that people delay are largely economic. For every single year that a woman delays her first birth, a college-educated woman, she gains 12% in annual earnings for her lifetime. So anyway, these are huge issues.
No,
and
I
left
agree.
Out of this discussion.
And I want to pursue all of those implications and benefits, as you argue, as we proceed. But one more thought, if I would, before I bring Joan Williams into our conversation, about whether or not you feel that the association with the developmental problems that Judith Shulevitz was outlining do you feel that those are overstated, or would you concur that those are real concerns that we need to pay attention to?
I would say they were overstated, and every single instance in the article, they were associated with the word might. Maybe, you know, they're all sort of except in the case of schizophrenia, where there's a clear connection between male sperm. One thing that's interesting associated here also with later motherhood is later mothers are much more likely to marry younger men than women who marry in their 20s. So the answer, you know, to that concern in a sort of joking way is, well, clearly younger men are the people that older women should marry. But I also wanted to address the issue of early death, which was a big part of the
before you do.
Also.
Before you do, we'll come to that as well. There's so many issues here, but I want to get Joan Williams' thoughts on this topic as well. As you hear these arguments going back and forth, both the sort of biological and child development concerns, but also what Elizabeth Gregory was arguing, that having children later has opened up so many possibilities and opportunities for women that was not the case before. As someone who works in this area in terms of work and life and the choices that both men and women have, where do you come down on this?
Well, I start out by pointing out that I think that all three of us are feminists and all three of us are listening to women's voices. I think that what Elizabeth found is that women choose to create happy lives with the choices they're given. I don't think that proves that they would prefer to have different choices. And I suspect, and Elizabeth, I know, will say more about this, the reason, first of all, this is a class effect. Not all women are having children later. It's professional managerial women primarily who are having children later. And the reason they're doing it is because, to quote Arlie Hochschild, of the clockwork of male careers. Now, if the alternative is not having a career, yes, then they would prefer to have children later. But if and they would certainly prefer not to have children at 17. But the question is, would they prefer to have children at 27 or 37? The reason they're choosing 37 very often is because careers are designed in an irrational way for the workforce of 1960, which didn't include women.
Are you saying, Joan Williams, and you too were someone who had your first child later in life, in late 30s, that if you could have, you would have rather have had that first child earlier on?
Yes. I was told in law school by an older student, don't wait too long to have kids because I'm having a lot of trouble having them. That made a deep impression on me. I was one of the fairly early women law professors. I thought that I would be foolhardy to try to have children before tenure. And so I didn't. I would say 20 minutes later, I got on that case. But as a result, I had both of my children on Clomid. And when I talk to younger women, I always tell them, have your children when you need to have your children. There is no perfect time from a career standpoint. And I was almost infertile. And that's no joke.
And so coming back to you on this, Judith Shilovitz, Clomid, one of the drugs that Joan Williams just mentioned, is one of those drugs that you can take to increase the possibility of conception. And you're saying that's one of the things that we just don't understand, that we are at a point where we can do various things to assist reproduction, but we don't really know all the consequences?
That's right. We're beginning, because of a revolution in environmental science, which involved trying to understand the effects of hormones on animal fertility, which came out of a study of various collapsing bird and fish populations in the Great Lakes. And that's something that's happened well over a decade ago. Scientists in the medical world are importing these concerns involving endocrine disruptors into the world of human fertility. Sperm counts are down around the world, for example, possibly because of the toxins we're absorbing. And Clomid is, you know, a hormone dysregulator intentionally. It stimulates the ovaries. It's a complicated process I won't go into here. It's not itself a hormone. But it stimulates, hyperstimulates the ovaries to release eggs. And again, the experience of environmental researchers that all kinds of things that seem perfectly safe and were introduced into the environment, in fact, have these horrific unintended consequences should give us pause. Now, I want to also say that I would agree with Joan. I am a feminist, and I'm not advocating for less choice. I'm advocating for more choice. I think it is true that women are constrained by economic incentives and disincentives not to have their children earlier for the very reason Elizabeth Gregory outlined. If you have your children earlier, you reduce lifetime earnings. And if you wait, you increase them. So if you want, you aspire to the professional and managerial classes or even the middle classes, if you're poor, you just are hugely incentivized to wait and even pushed.
How do you respond, though, to Elizabeth Gregory's central point, which is the women she interviewed for her book are largely happy with the choice they made, and that this has enabled women to play a larger role in work life and career life, in policy-making decisions which benefit women generally?
Well, I would like to see women in these positions without having to sacrifice having the families they want. It would be men are able to enter the policy world with families. I don't see why women can't, except, of course, now it's not made possible. Some women are very happy delaying. I would not trade. I met my husband at 34. I married at 36. I would not be married to anyone other than the man I'm married to. I would not trade in my children. Once you have a family, it's inconceivable that you would have any other family. That's just a human response. So I'm not dealing with individual happiness or unhappiness because I think, you know, you are happy with the choices you've made because you made them in a universe of possible choices. I want to expand the universe of possible choices so that so that Joan could have had her children earlier, so that I would have had my children earlier, because if I'd known what a great experience it was, I would have had more.
And Elizabeth Gregory, how do you weigh then this balance between what Judith is arguing is that we're kind of conducting an experiment where we don't really know what is going to happen with some of these technologies that we're currently utilizing versus what you're arguing that this experiment has given women so many more opportunities?
I don't think they're contradictory. I think it's true that the fertility industry definitely is under regulated and under tracked, and there's a lot of information that we need and that we should have and that they don't give us because it's not to their advantage, but somebody needs to regulate them. On the other hand, there's a lot of information, misinformation out there about the real dynamics of fertility apart from fertility technology. People are told, you know, constantly, at 35, things go downhill fast in this radical way. And it's true, but they don't get real statistics. You get instead these overstated statistics. At 35, people have about an 11% fertility rate, infertility rate. At 40, they have about a 33% infertility rate. At 41, they have about a 50% infertility rate, and it really falls quickly between 41 and 43 to very little. That kind of statistic is not what you hear. Most people in their late 30s have a likelihood of getting pregnant if they just keep trying for 2 years. That, of course, doesn't give them a lot of time to have three children, so they could maybe have two children and three if they're lucky, or if they have triplets or twins, which are sometimes a natural phenomenon anyway in later age. So there are all these dynamics that are just not discussed.
Yeah.
So let me just note that the kind of headline, and in a way I can agree with the headline that went with this article, because I think it will upend things in a positive way. But the implication in the article is that it will upend things in a negative way. There was a story just a few years ago saying women have 10% of their eggs at 30. I don't know if you remember that story, but I, you know, that kind of headline grabs attention.
I actually do remember it, Elizabeth, and I remember telling my students you should definitely have your kids by age 27 if you only want to have sex once.
Right, but if you click through on that story, on 10% of the eggs, first it turned out it was actually rounded up from 12, what they were comparing it to was relative to a 20-week-old fetus. It was completely useless information. If you compared it to a 25-year-old woman, she had 22% of her eggs. And basically 12% was what you needed. Nobody really has issues at 30 in the proportion that, you know, would make people worried. It's about 4%.
I'm going to hold us, if I might, on the statistics for a moment. It's a useful point, and always a useful point, to remember that statistics can play out in different ways, and it's important to understand the context. But we're about to go away for a break, and I want to open up our phone lines and hear from all of you about your thoughts on this question of the benefits and the concerns about having children later in life. The number, if you want to join our conversation, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. forum@kqed.org. Before we go to our break, Joan Williams, just one more thought from you about what you think are, when you talk with those younger law students of yours, how you begin to sort of weigh all of this. What is it that you suggest that they consider when there's so many factors involved?
Well, first of all, I suggest they should have better choices than they do, and that the workplace is not designed for people like them. And then I say, as I mentioned, have your kids when you need to have your kids. Now, keep in mind, I'm not telling people to have kids at age 20. I'm already dealing with people who are 26. But there is no perfect time, and you can make anything work. And as Judith has pointed out, you'll have a wonderful family, and you will love them.
We'll talk more about how to make it all work when we return. Again, the number 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts and questions on our Facebook page. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour: having children later in life and the consequences of that for parents, for children, and for society. Judith Shulevitz wrote a provocative and thoughtful story in The New Republic called How Older Parenthood Will Upend American Society, and that's the topic we're focusing on this hour, along with Elizabeth Gregory, the director of the Women's Studies Program at the University of Houston, and Joan Williams, professor of law and director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California's Hastings College of the Law. We'd like to hear from you as well. You can join us at 866 733 833-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Lots of comments coming in on our Facebook page and on our email site as well. Lauren writes, having kids over 35 makes you an older parent. That's not my experience in the Bay Area. I had my oldest when I was 33, and I'm far from the oldest mom in her second grade class. Anastasia writes, my husband is 14 years older than me. It never occurred to me that my kids would not have grandparents. Michelle writes that she was 38 and that there's been many good things about that. But then she goes on to say that I do worry about having teenagers when I'm in my 50s. Many more comments coming in, lots of phone calls as well. Let's take our first caller. Margo joins us from Berkeley. Margo, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to comment on the fertility doctors and the industry around trying to get women to go straight to IVF or donor eggs and without giving them a chance to try and do it in a more natural way. And I'm 54, and I had my children when I was 45 and 48, and I went to 5 fertility doctors, and they all told me that I had to do ICSI and go straight to IVF without trying more natural things, which is what I ended up with, a wonderful midwife who helped me, counseled me, and took me under her wing and helped me have my kids in a very natural way.
Margo, thanks. Judith, you write about this as well, that there's a tendency to sort of jump to that solution and that really there are perhaps more opportunities than sometimes women realize.
I think that's right. I mean, I tell my own story how I went to Clomid pretty early in the process, which I slightly regret now. Again, you can never know if any one child's sort of difficulties stem from any one thing you did. We're dealing only with statistical averages and large populations. As I said, I had terrible handwriting as a child, and maybe his fine motor delay was purely inherited from me and had nothing to do with the Clomid. But there's this anxiety that you feel as your fertility is declining with the rapidity that Elizabeth laid out, that you're going to really miss the boat. And fertility treatments also decline in efficacy as you get older. I think Margot was really lucky to get pregnant by natural means at 45 and 48 because you really are dealing with very low fertility levels at that point. There was a very influential and important New England Journal of Medicine article that came out in May, which sort of compared the rates of birth defects associated with different processes. And actually, IVF did not come out badly. But IVF combined with ICSI, which is a process in which you actually inject sperm into the egg instead of allowing it to sort of meet with the sperm to meet with the egg in the petri dish naturally, there are a high rate of birth defects associated with that and maybe with Clomid as well. So there are different processes that may have different results. I am certainly not saying that all assisted reproductive technology is dangerous. I'm simply saying proceed with caution and don't necessarily, as Marco says, listen to the fertility doctors because they are interested parties. They want you as their customers.
Marco, thanks for the call. One thing I've been wondering about, Joan Williams, perhaps you have a thought on, is that sense that that somehow age doesn't matter, that there's this sense that we'll always have choices, there'll always be time, that you continue to have, we'll always have opportunity. I think many of us raised our children with that thought in mind. Do you think that that's part of what's going on, that people really aren't wanting to face the reality of biology?
I don't think so. I think many people would prefer to have their children in their late 20s or early 30s. And I think they don't do that for career reasons. And I think that careers should start to be designed for the workforce that we have, which is not only women who want that, but want to do that, but also men. One of the things that Judith has done is added men into the discussion. And I think that's an extremely important thing to do. And if we had career opportunities where you could take a career break, where you didn't have to work 50, 60 hours a week in these professions, then I think you'd see lots of people who would prefer to have their children at a different time.
Ashley in St. Helena has our next thought. Go ahead, Ashley.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm the daughter of a mother who was 40 and a father who was 45 when they had me, and I felt a lot of pressure to have my kids as early as possible just because I wanted them to know their grandparents. And now I have a 2-year-old, and, you know, my mom's almost 70, my dad's 75, so they're just not able to do, you know, even now, all of the things that I had hoped, all of the support that I had hoped for, just the energy. It takes a lot of their energy to take care of my 2-year-old, and I'm so thankful that I was able to have children and find a partner as early as I did, but it's a real consideration, I think, for people in the long run.
Ashley, thanks. Elizabeth Gregory, why don't you respond to that, about the question about the role and relationship to grandparents in particular, and how having children later in life impacts that?
It varies. I gather Ashley must be around 30. Is that something around that?
I'm 29.
29. Yep. And that is the average age at which, just about 30 is the average age at which college-educated women in the U.S. have their first child. So that's... But you're talking about the effect of multiple generations of late birth.
Well, one of the issues that's come up in some of these articles and discussion that we're having today as well is this idea that you lose something when you don't have the possibility of having actively engaged grandparents as well, if you have your children much later in life.
And that's true. You do, to a degree. Of course, in not such a long time ago, many people didn't have grandparents at all. So, you know, it's not as though there were some model of family dynamics that was static in the past, in which everything was some sort of natural dynamic. This is already, you know, we've added 30 years to the average lifespan in the past 100 years, and that means people are living a lot longer than they did. So they're not going to be what they were when they're 50, when they're 70. I have two children. I'm 55. I have a 15-year-old who was born when I was 39, and an 8-year-old who was adopted when I was 47. So I'm sort of living all these dynamics also,
yeah.
And sort of in two versions. And my parents certainly are less likely to jump around than they would have been 20 years earlier. But they are present, and they're very much part of my children's lives. Some people will not have that, and that is an effect. But I also can I address an issue that was raised in the article about early death of the parents themselves. Isn't that something that you...
Yeah, no, go ahead briefly if you would, though.
Because Judith talks about the concern that people will die when their children are, you know, 30-something or 40-something. Is that right? And one interesting fact about later parents is that they are actually much less likely to die. They live much longer than other parents. This is both... demonstrated in terms of studies of centenarians. So they looked at people who were 100 in 1996, who were born in 1896. They were, if they had had a child in their 40, they were 4 times more likely to live to be 100 as women who had not had a child in their 40s. And these are people who were just having births in the 1940s before there was any fertility treatment.
Well, let me just personalize this question for a moment. Is that something you worry about, Joan Williams, about dying before your children are sort of fully launched?
I don't worry about dying before my children were fully launched. All three of us are very characteristic of our generations. I had my first child at 35 and my second child at 37. I do worry about being older than I would like when I have grandchildren. And whenever I say that to my kids, my daughter says, "Mom, I can solve that problem in 9 months." And I go, no, for all of the reasons that we've been talking about, the career reasons.
Let's go to another call. Danielle joins us in San Rafael. Danielle, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a new mother of a 13-month-old little girl. I had her when I was 35. And I waited because I went to graduate school and got my professional license and started off in my career. I'm finding that it's very challenging to, one, go back to work and leave her, but also to manage the balance between a professional full-time job and being a full-time mother as well, like still breastfeeding and taking care of her, especially when she gets sick. So I'm finding a lot of my friends who also have children late struggling with, they've developed these very prosperous careers, but now wanting to stay home with their children. And I just wanted to see if the callers could comment on the, how common that is for women who have children later in life.
Danielle, thanks. Judith Shulevitz.
Well, I think it's very common. I think we live in a country that is uniquely unhelpful in this regard, or at least one of the industrialized nations that is. We have, you know, very short parental leave, sometimes unpaid. We don't have much subsidized child care. There are governmental institutions that other countries try to help women in this situation. We don't have them. We don't compel corporations to give them. So I do think it's very difficult. And I say in my article that, you know, we will not have an equal society until we equally distribute the opportunity cost. That's what you forego for having children between women and men. So the further along in your career, the more you're earning, the more you give up if you decide, well, I just cannot have this child raised by nannies or babysitters. I want to be with this child. When that, you're giving up more, which is unfair.
Danielle,
go ahead.
Danielle, thanks for the call. Joan Williams, you wanted to add something?
I'd like to jump in here. I mean, Judith is right. We have the most family-hostile public policy in the entire developed world. We're lumped with countries like Swaziland in terms of the quality of the policies that we have. But I wanted to talk to the caller in a more personal way. I think it's very natural for many people, inevitable, to feel the tug when you're facing leaving a baby. But I really urge her to think about long-term versus short-term. Although it's difficult to leave the baby, staying home and giving up your career, first of all, is placing that child's economic future really in jeopardy. It's really hang gliding with your child's future because, unfortunately, partners die, partners divorce, and even taking a career break, and I think this is absolutely outrageous, but demographically, a woman who takes 1 year off loses 20% of her lifetime earnings, and 2 or 3 years off, you lose 30% of your lifetime earnings. So I would just urge her to hang in there. It's not easy, but the alternatives aren't easy either.
Some comments coming in on our Facebook page. Todd writes, as a father having a child when I was 41 with a mother of 31, I was infinitely more prepared to have a child than I would have been 5 years earlier. This readiness was full-fledged, emotional readiness, career readiness, readiness to help make sure my daughter had every developmental and nutritional benefit, and goes on with more on that point. Respond to that, if you would, Joan Williams, that there is a readiness factor that comes when you have a child later that's a real benefit.
Well, I'd love to hear what Elizabeth says about that, because I think that's the point that Elizabeth is trying to capture. And for that person, you know what? They had a baby at exactly the right time.
And that's where the title of my book, Ready, came from, because everybody said they had children when they felt ready. And, you know, there was another dynamic that relates to what Joan was saying. A lot of the women that I spoke to had seen their mothers stuck in marriages that they couldn't leave because they couldn't afford to take care of their kids if they left. And they just swore they would not do that. So they wanted to be economically freestanding. And they found that this also affected the dynamic of their marriage, because if you don't have to stay, you probably won't want to leave, if you see what I mean. That it won't create this negative power dynamic of one person having all the influence and money, and it will just be a much more equitable dynamic. So people found that there were benefits that were not just economic but also psychological, and you have what's called a peer marriage, which means that not only when you have equal salaries and equal education, that means there's equal or much more equal cooperation in child raising, and that's what you've seen Alan Galinsky doing all this work on young men being much more invested in the care of their children.
Let's hear from some other people on this question of readiness as well, and how you go about determining that. Mary in Menlo Park is our next caller. Mary, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Right now I'm 54, and I have a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old, so I had them when I was 41 and 43. I wasn't really thinking about having kids until I was at least 35, and then my marriage ended and I had to find somebody to have kids with. So that timing was okay. People did look at me as an example of someone having kids later. I was incredibly lucky to have both my children without any type of assistance, and I didn't realize that until I had them. I also found it really difficult to have a career and have both kids. Because I was older and I had waited for my children, and financially we were better off, I felt like I could take the time off of work and just stay at home with them.
So, are you glad, or do you regret having waited as you did, Mary?
I kind of regret it because I would have liked to have had more. Having my daughter at 43 was the upper limit of when I could have had a healthy kid, I think. As it was, you know, we were waiting on pins and needles for the results of the amnio. When you're going through your 20s and 30s, you don't think about getting older. Well, when you're going through your 40s and 50s, you don't think about getting older either. One of the downsides of waiting, besides only being able to have two kids, is realizing that some of the things that I like to do when the kids are ready to do, like, you know, scuba dive and backpack and maybe climb Machu Picchu, when they're in their upper teens and ready to do that, I may be too old to do that.
Mary, thanks. Thanks for adding in your thoughts on that. Let's go right to another caller. Addie in Cupertino is next. Addie, go ahead.
Hi there. I think I got to experience really both sides of sort of having a young kid or having my first kid while I was young, 27, and my second child when I was 37. So with my first child, you know, my parents at that point were in their 50s, and they were, you know, they had a lot of energy. They were very interested, fabulous grandparents. I was a single parent at that time, and so really I was able to continue working, but it really took a village. There was no way I could have done that on my own. You know, fast forward, I have my second child 9 years later, and they're older, you know, approaching their 70s. The energy level's not there. But I also feel economically I'm better equipped and also emotionally better equipped to be a better parent now. So I feel fortunate, actually, that I was able to do both, but it's a pretty different experience.
Addie, thanks. It's time to hear from a man. Brandon in Potrero is up next. Or sorry, Brandon, I missed you. We'll get back right to you, I promise. Isabel is on the line. Go ahead, Isabel.
Hi, and hi, Professor Williams. I actually was a UC Hastings student as a single parent with a 4- and 7-year-old at the time. And I had my first child at 23, so my experience was that of being a young parent, and I integrated those things by actually just forcing my way through graduate school with children by not asking for permission, because I knew it wouldn't be given to me. So I took my infant daughter through my master's program and breastfed her through classes and ignored protests. And then, you know, when my kids didn't have school, I took them with me to Hastings, and I'm sure some professors remember that. My experience now as a 40-year-old is that if I were to consider having more children, I would face the exact same issues, which is that there is no systemic support for integrating parenting with, earning a living wage. And so
let me hold you there, if I might, Isabel, because this raises an interesting question that I'd like to get some thoughts on. Joan Williams, do you have to be like Isabel without having the policies that you're all arguing we ought to have? Do you have to be like Isabel?
I was sitting here applauding. I mean, congratulations, Isabel. It takes incredible dedication and fervor to do what you did. And I think I'm proud that Hastings accommodated you to some extent. At Hastings, for example, we have 3 professors who have taken 10 years off of their careers. And when they went back on the market, we embraced them and we said, you're bright, talented people. That should be far more common.
And Judith Shulevitz, what would you add about the sort of attributes you need in order to contend with a work environment and a policy orientation that makes it necessary to act as Isabel needed to?
She's a heroine, and it's a wonderful story, and I'm impressed. And it shouldn't take heroism. It should be easier that she felt so isolated that she felt she had to sort of not ask permission. and just show up in class with babies and children says a lot. It says it all. And education, so I talk in the article about how even Sweden, which pegs its generous parental leaves to earnings before you take the time off, in the end winds up discriminating against people who are getting graduate degrees who have no earnings. There should be a way to help people get through graduate school because that is when they're in their late 20s and still be able to have children. You know, there are, should be ways of stopping not just the tenure clock but the educational clock, and that's very, very difficult. And I'm also glad to hear that Hastings has such progressive policies.
There's
General Williams.
I think this is incredibly important, and we're really here at the nub of the issue, which is from a macroeconomic standpoint, does organizing the workplace the way we've organized it make sense? And the easy answer is no. Women in science are a very good example. Women in science, we pay lots of money to educate people in science, and then the drop-off rate when women are postdocs is incredibly high. And that's because they realize they're in this family hostile atmosphere, both in terms of public policy and in terms of the workplace, and they are not going to be able to make it work. That makes no sense from a macroeconomic standpoint.
I want to get to another issue that someone emailed us in about. And this person writes, I'm an older parent with two children, having my first child at 41, second at 43. My age never seemed to be an issue to me at the time when I was trying to have children. However, now that I'm a parent of teenagers in my late 50s, I really believe that having children later is a detriment to those children. It may be great for me, but I think my children worry about losing their parents when they're still young. This is something that you say was one of your fundamental concerns, Judith Shulevitz.
Well, I experience it very personally. My children, who are 9 and 10 now, say to me, you know, they do the math, which they can do now, and they say, you were 39 and 40 when you had your children. What if I wait as long as you did? You'll be 80 or almost 80. And I say to them, don't wait as long as I did. Now, Joan might say that's short-sighted, and she might be right. Do I really want my daughter having children at 25 because before she's had gotten her graduate degrees, which I'm sure she'll get because she's very bright? Maybe not. But I'm hoping, as I say at the very end of the article, that the world will have changed by that time because I don't want to be 80 when they have their children.
Here's another question that I'd like to raise, and I'll come to you with this, and you can add that in as well, Elizabeth Gregory. Can you please at least acknowledge that older women could choose to adopt rather than conceive, which was a choice you made?
Yes, and adoption is a realm in which women have been older mothers. Let me point out that people have been older mothers for millennia. They right. would just intend to be their first children. They were their 12th or their 13th children. People were, you know, my grandmother had a child at 39. It was her 8th child. It was my first child. So it's not as though this is a new phenomenon in the world. People have done this physically and by adoption for millennia. And certainly that's a huge part of the later motherhood experience today. Lots of people adopt or foster. There's this huge population of stepmothers who are also adoptive mothers. So there are a lot of different experiences. I would join also with the discussion about the, you know, how this is, the way things are is not the way it should be, but the only way in which this change will occur is because of delay. And the moment for the speaker, the caller, Danielle, who was concerned about, you know, should she take off from work, well, this is the moment not just to hunker down, but also to protest, because there is growing a critical mass of women out there. So we can say, you know, this is the way it is now, but it doesn't have to be that way. So elect more women to Congress. Get the issues on the table. Don't just have people say childcare, national childcare system, people say impossible. So you just say it again. Say, no, we have to talk about it. We can't not talk about these issues. The reason they haven't been discussed is because women haven't been at the table. Women are at the table, so raise your voices.
Joan Williams.
I wanted to say one word about adoption because we've talked so much in this hour, and I've appreciated the thoughtful discussion, Dave, about the pain of infertility. And as someone who went through that, it's very painful. But as I look back, you know, if I had not had biological children, What I would have done, I love children, is adopted children and had a wonderful family. And I just want people who are listening to this to hear that.
Let's get in one more quick thought from Rory. It's time for a male voice. Rory, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of comment on the lack of the medical community concerning education on endometriosis. I think women of college age, if they had any information on that, would maybe change the thought process as far as when they decide to start having children. My wife was 32 before we found out she had endometriosis, and we've been trying for 2.5 years naturally. Nothing worked, 3 rounds of IUI, a round of IVF. It wasn't until 5 years later we just got real lucky and ended up conceiving naturally, and we now have a 1-month-old. But she definitely would have started trying earlier if she'd known in her 20s that she wasn't going to be able to have children.
Yeah, Rory, thank you. It's among other things we can all agree on this, is this is an arena where we're learning more and being assertive about finding out more is important. Last quick thought from you, Judith Shulowitz. You wrote an article that got a lot of people thinking. What would you like them to continue to think about?
Well, I want to sort of go back to a discussion Elizabeth and Joan were having about the importance of staying in the workplace, which I agree with. It was not my experience. Luckily, I was a writer. I was able to sort of drop out of sight, write a book, and, you know, spend a lot of time parenting, also while claiming to people in the outside world that I was really working because I was working on a book and not losing face that way. But I spent time with my children that I think I would not ever have missed. Hmm. And I regret so deeply that people have to choose to miss it. The world should not be that way. And if you make the decision to stay home, yes, it will cost you economically, and it may cost you in terms of power and agency in the world, but it is, in fact, an extraordinary experience.
Judith Shulowitz, thanks so much for writing the article and getting us started on this conversation, which we will no doubt need to continue. Thanks as well to Elizabeth Gregory and Joan Williams for their participation in our conversation, and to all of you for adding your thoughts on email and by calls as well. Thank you for that. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.